Sea-Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 383. Sunday, December 13th, 2020.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey everybody, KMO here, and Danger Dead Nettles sent me something from Dmitry Orlov today, and I read it, and I nodded at parts, and kind of rolled my eyes at parts, and I was going to come here and just read the whole thing to you, figuring Dmitry wouldn't mind. I mean, if it's a publicly available post, so what if I, you know, put it to music, as it were. And then I was situated here at my computer, microphone ready to go, and I noticed, oh no, this is a patrons-only post. Even I shouldn't have seen this. So I'm not going to read it to you. But I will summarize parts of it for you. And basically, Dmitry, he lays out a scenario. He's talking, he's asking questions and then providing answers. Like, suppose you are the evil masterminds behind the global economy, and you've got some problems that you want to solve. What do you do? What are the problems, and what do you do about them? Well, one of the problems is peak oil. So, you know, his position is pretty familiar to anybody who's, you know, been in the peak oil scene, that fracking, while it has kept things going much longer than anticipated, can't go on forever, and that, you know, most fracking companies fail, and that, you know, the party will soon be over. And that's a problem. So what does this virus, which is not particularly, you know, dangerous on its own. Most of the people who die from it probably would have died from something else pretty soon. What does this virus get us? You know, us, the global elite. Well, it allows us to put the economy into a medically induced coma. And also, by, you know, propagating fear, fear of infection, we're getting people to move out of the cities, to disperse themselves across the landscape, and we're sifting. You know, we're finding out who can telecommute and who can't, whose labor is actually necessary and whose isn't. But not only is the plan to distribute people around the country, you know, get them to disperse from the cities, go out into the hinterlands and work from there. Once the spreading is effected, then you want to lock things down so people can't travel easily. And this is a point I've heard Dmitry make before, just even in, you know, face-to-face conversation, that gasoline is really almost a waste byproduct of the petroleum distillation process, which gives us the actual necessary fuels that are jet fuel and bunker fuel and diesel fuel, you know, to run planes, trains, and automobiles. But big automobiles, trucks, lorries, as you Brits would say. And now that the economy has slowed down and less of those actually essential fuels are necessary, there's no real need to keep people driving around in cars to, you know, take up the what otherwise would have been a waste product, the gasoline. Now, another benefit of distributing people out across the countryside, and rather than having them clustered in cities, is people who are thinly distributed, like I am here, you know, in southern Vermont, they can't really protest. They can't really riot. There's just not the population density necessary to engage in those sorts of activities, which can be threatening to the power of the global elites, or the evil geniuses, as he calls them in this post. Now, the goal of the evil geniuses here is to perpetuate the system. You know, the system as it is constituted and, you know, running at the scale that it was running at before COVID-19 was unsustainable in the extreme. Like, you know, the cliff edge was approaching visibly. So what's the plan? The plan is to shut down parts of the economy that are not necessary to, you know, the well-being of the evil geniuses, and to keep other parts of the economy, which is of use to the evil geniuses, not only up and running, but still growing. So what needs to be shut down? Well, global tourism needs to be shut down. And the virus has done a great job at, you know, throttling the airlines and depressing hotels and just about everybody, you know, every other sort of business that depends on routine global pleasure travel. He says that cruise ships are being cut up for scrap metal. And he also, you might say asserts, you might say postulates, you know, he's just spinning a scenario here. And in this scenario that he's spinning, which is seemingly in, it's seemingly congruent with observable facts on the ground, that one of the essential ingredients in getting people to run away from the cities is to let crime and the sort of protests we've seen this year run rampant. You know, that drives the rich people away, it drives the conservative people away, the cautious people, the people who are, you know, who don't want to be associated with that sort of civil unrest and disturbance, who don't want to be subject to it, and who certainly don't want to participate in it. It prompts them to insulate themselves and make themselves not dependent on the cities. Which, again, is great for the powers that be. You know, go live in the woods, go live in your commune, unplug as much as you can from the system, which is to say, release the system from any obligation you thought it owed you to help sustain you. That's a point I've been making forever, is that, you know, turning on, tuning in, and dropping out is great for the man when the man's job is to provide for everybody and the man doesn't have the will, the wherewithal, or the skills to do so. Another benefit to this plan is that when you deliberately encourage cities to collapse into chaos under rioting and looting and protests, that what you're doing is you're encouraging the criminal class, basically young men with nothing to lose and lots of testosterone and no girlfriends, and that's my addition, no girlfriends, and really nothing materially to lose from going out and battling the police or whatever. You basically, this is an invitation for the criminal class who can be legally enslaved in the United States under the 13th Amendment to raise their hand, step forward. Who would like to be the new slave labor? So in cities which are thoroughly surveilled, not only with cameras, but, you know, cameras that are powered by AI with facial recognition and all sorts of machine learning algorithms, which can take all manner of data from different sources and turn it into a step-by-step, you know, turn-by-turn timeline of where any individual has been in recent history, it is very easy to identify the criminals and to hunt them down, capture them, and put them to work at either no pay or a dollar an hour or a dollar a day, you know, something absurd, slave wages. So one of the points of putting the global economy into this, you know, deliberately induced economic coma is to, it's basically a stress test to see which economies are stable enough and robust enough to endure this and emerge from it. And another thing it does is it gives the evil geniuses time to solve some major problems which have been vexing them for some time. For example, the longevity of the population. People are living longer. They're scheduled to spend much longer in retirement, retirement which is to be funded by retirement programs, retirement funds, you know, pension plans, things that were designed in an era where people didn't live nearly as long. They don't really work when people are living 2-3 extra decades. Those people either need to get back to work or they need to die, but they can't just sit in retirement for decades at a time. Retirement was never meant to, you know, to sustain people for decades at a time. Another problem, according to Dimitri, a problem for the evil geniuses, is automation. We have too much of it. We need to shift production manual, you know, we need to shift physical production back to manual labor. At the same time, the elites still definitely need artificial intelligence. And one of the reasons they need artificial intelligence is they want to dumb down the population in order to prevent them from, you know, effecting any sort of resistance to this plan. So human intellectual activity will increasingly be taken up by AI running on cloud servers somewhere. But in terms of, you know, robots making stuff, better to train the monkeys to turn the wrenches themselves. And finally, the problem of reclustering. You know, once you have sifted the economies to see which ones sink and which ones are able to swim, at least, you know, in this circumstance, then you want to take the winners and you want to cluster them together into, you know, new alliances, new supply chains, new cultural and economic cooperative arrangements, and to then to just discard the rest. And that reminds me of Peter Zeihan's notion that, you know, the United States, which for the latter half of the 20th century and well into the first two decades of the 21st century, has been the guarantor of safe passage on the high seas. Anybody can travel the seas, you know, and you don't need armed escorts for your commercial vehicles. You can just set out from anywhere to anywhere, pretty much, and you don't have to worry about fending off, you know, armed attacks. There are a couple notable examples when big oil tankers cruise, you know, down the eastern coast of Africa. There's a lot of very poor people there who have discovered that the tanker companies have no appetite whatsoever for armed conflict and would rather just pay the ransom, whatever it is. But for the most part, people can ship from anywhere to anywhere. And Peter Zion's scenario that he spins out is that the U.S. is going to step back from that obligation, and we're really only going to protect the shipments to our major trading partners. And two of our most, you know, and two of our biggest trading partners, our most important trading partners, they're connected to us by land. You know, we don't need ocean transport so much to move goods from Canada and Mexico into the United States and vice versa. But the U.S. will still be committed to South Korea and Japan, and thus, you know, and also committed to controlling the Pacific, because that's our doorstep, and also to, you know, stifle the ambitions of China to invade or otherwise reacquire Taiwan. So again, I've shifted here from Dmitry Orlov to Peter Zion, but back to Dmitry Orlov. So, you know, the way he's framed this, there are evil geniuses that run the global economy, except for China and Russia, who are the resistance to this evil global cabal of geniuses. But I was reminded of the right-wing conspiracy narrative around Agenda 21. And the idea there was that large parts of, you know, the less inhabited parts of the countryside will be completely cleared out. Everybody will be forced into the cities where they will be, you know, carefully surveilled and monitored. And part of the Agenda 21 conspiracy narrative is that, you know, the evil geniuses are also environmentalists, and they want humans to vacate the landscape so that the landscape can regenerate itself. And there's no hint of that that I can detect in Dmitry's scenario here. And the interesting distinction I saw between the two was that, you know, the Agenda 21 notion is that people will be forced into cities, and Dmitry's narrative is that people who can flee the cities, who have the means to flee the cities, are being encouraged to do so, and that they will largely be, you know, the intellectual class anyway, the people who will be doing the sorts of work that can be done from anywhere via Zoom conference and file uploads and, you know, all the tools that we've become accustomed to here in 2020. So I kind of see Dmitry's scenario here as Agenda 21 updated for people who don't have the certain set of cultural values and assumptions that are built into the, you know, the red tribe here in the United States. The idea that environmentalism at all levels is either misguided or, you know, downright evil, because it stymies the human ability to work hard, acquire property, acquire capital, and improve oneself and improve one's life and the lives of one's family and loved ones and community. Now that I've, you know, openly compared Dmitry's scenario here to Agenda 21, you could reasonably wonder, you know, if I'm dismissing it as a conspiracy theory. But as I've outlined elsewhere, I probably don't need to go into it again, I think that the idea that you can shut down an idea or discredit it just with the use of that phrase, conspiracy theory, is, you know, it is not respectable discourse. That's a rhetorical trick, a cheap rhetorical trick, to which I give no weight at all. You know, dismissing something as a conspiracy narrative simply because, you know, it does not accord with the official narrative. So I think what I'm going to do now is just edit down this monologue a little bit, and I'm going to play it at the beginning of my daily drawing live stream. And I'll see what the people in the chat and what the scheduled guests have to say in response to it, and then I will include some of that feedback into my next recording session. So prepare for a jump forward in time starting right now. All right, well, it's now a couple days later, and I played that recording on the live stream on Friday. In fact, I played it twice. I played it when the live stream first started, and I played it again after a few people had tuned in. One of the people that heard it the second time through was Bronwyn, who decided to be identified as Bronwyn. That is her actual name. She was B on a fairly recent episode of the C-Rome Vault podcast. So she had never heard of Dmitry Orlov. In fact, that's what she's going to say here at the beginning of the comments that I've excerpted from that drawing live stream. So here's a bit of Bronwyn responding to that.
Yes.
What thoughts leapt to mind as you heard that?
Oh dear. Well, I have never heard of Dimitri before. So that was an introduction to me. Is this a friend of yours, KMO?
He is somebody with whom I am personally acquainted, yeah.
Oh. I was just curious just because it's not that I would expect myself to know who this person was, but it was an interesting theory he has about the pandemic. I had a couple questions that I feel like I should do some research before I actually comment, but I would
ask the questions right now, and Les and Ed and maybe Dryland Fish here in the chat would have good answers.
Sure. Well, you and or he keeps referring to these evil geniuses, and I wish there was specificity around who the evil geniuses are, or who he is referring to specifically, rather than just this sort of blanketed statement of evil genius. So I had that question. The other question was, I need to refresh my mind on what the 13th Amendment stands for, which is interesting because I've recently started rereading the Constitution. So, which is not an easy read in case you decide you wish to do it. Yeah, similar to the Bible. That'll be the next one.
Often quoted Little Red, yeah. So exactly. The 13th Amendment was meant to flee the slaves, but what it really did was made corporations into humans or into people, persons.
Yes.
It states, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. So basically, it outlaws slavery or involuntary servitude except for prisoners. If you've been arrested and convicted, then you can be enslaved, and it's perfectly kosher with the Constitution.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, gee, I know some incarcerated individuals. I'm sure they do feel like slaves, particularly right now, but if they're actually, they're still in jail. But actually, incarcerated individuals still feel like slaves and prisoners even after they've come out of incarceration, just simply because of the way all the difficulties they put in your path to make yourself become a more normal citizen. they certainly don't make it easy for you to reform yourself back into society. And then, of course, society isn't very welcoming from my experience of people, close friends and people that I know who've been incarcerated. Even if the reform system was better, I think society's feelings around people who've been in jail are not very welcoming, and they don't necessarily offer much I can't think of the word, but welcoming is maybe the best word I can come up with right now. Well, I mean, he has an interesting point about what he's talking about. I suppose there are a few things that that I sort of, well, things I've heard before from other conspiracy theories about the pandemic and about COVID-19. I've certainly listened to Alex Jones and some of his conspiracy theories about the pandemic. And I don't discount them, and I don't consider, just because somebody says it's conspiracy theory, I actually look things up and fact check things. So if somebody calls it a conspiracy theory, that's just an opinion. I sometimes actually think some of these conspiracy theories are truth. And I think it's the denial of of the general public to want to believe that our government would be doing such horrible things to us, but why wouldn't they? I don't know. I have mixed opinions about many things. I also don't know what Agenda 21 is. That was another question mark that I wanted to take time to look up, but haven't had the moment to do it.
Well, why don't you go ahead and look it up now, and I'm going to read through the comments of people who have been...
I have not had a chance to read them since I've been gabbing, talking too much. Yes. Okay, I see. Evil geniuses, Schwab, Soros, Gates. Yeah, okay, I agree. Those could be definitely evil geniuses. What about big tech? I consider them evil geniuses right now. Yeah. Big tech, Google, Facebook, Twitter. We could certainly take those three folks off the map. Of course, everybody would shit their pants because they'd be like, oh my God, I don't have internet, a social media. Oh no. Sorry. I have really bad opinions about social media and big tech at the moment. Because they're censoring a lot of voices that I think should be heard, but I won't go there. Let me Google. Speaking of Google, let's Google Agenda 21.
Let me spare you the effort. I've got the Wikipedia page up.
Oh, geez. KMO, you're so fast.
Agenda 21 is a non-binding action plan of the United Nations with regard to sustainable development. It is a product of the Earth Summit, UN Conference on Environment and Development, held in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil in 1992. It is an action agenda for the UN and other multilateral organizations and individual governments around the world that can be executed at local, national, and global levels. One major objective of Agenda 21 initiative is that every local government should draw its own local Agenda 21. Its aim initially was to achieve global sustainable development by 2000, with the 21 in the agenda referring to the original target of the 21st century. So that's the above the folds definition on Wikipedia, but now I'm skipping down to the conspiracy theories section. And it reads, far right-wing groups, now remember, Wikipedia is an extreme left-wing organization, so anything having to do with the right wing, they're gonna slant it really hard. So this is the Wikipedia take on the right-wing take on Agenda 21. Far right-wing groups, including the John Birch Society, assert that Agenda 21 is part of a scheme using environmental protection as a cover to impose a worldwide dictatorship. During her 2014 U.S. Senate campaign, Joni Ernst promoted a conspiracy theory claiming Agenda 21 would force Iowa farmers off their land and into the cities. So the Agenda 21, the right-wing conspiracy theory version of Agenda 21 is governments are going to push everybody into cities. They're going to make all wilderness areas no-go places for humans so that the wilderness can recover. And people living in the cities will be living under heavy surveillance. So it's the Alex Jones globalist long-term assault on individual freedom. So the fact that you've been listening to Alex Jones, but you haven't heard of Agenda 21 just shows that you haven't been
listening. Well, I mean, I did. Long. I don't listen to him all the time. I only listen to little bits and pieces because it's more things that my partner listens to. But I've heard of Agenda 21, but I haven't done a deep dive into any of the conspiracy thoughts. I have my own thoughts about what I think about what's going on in the country and with our government. But I don't always scroll through things and listen to stuff because I don't have time because I'm trying to be an artist and like earn a living, which I have none right now. So between running around trying to like earn an income, which is non-existent, and then do my own art, I have a hard time keeping up with all of the things I want to listen to in terms of podcasts and conspiracy theories and whatnot. But from my own observance of what's been happening since last February, I have my own opinions, but they're only my opinions. And sometimes I refrain to save all my opinions simply because they're controversial.
All right, that was Bronwyn. And as you can tell, the part of it that she really focused in on was the 13th Amendment and the fact that slavery is legal. And that's not some hyperbole. That's not some weird slanting of the 13th Amendment. That's how it's written. It says that slavery shall be prohibited except in the case of criminals and the punishment of criminals, where their labor can be coerced. But I also shared this with Jim D. Jim, your ad attacker of the Attack Ads podcast. And at first, you know, I just sent him my summation of what Dimitri said and, you know, my commentary. And when he wrote back, it was clear that my encapsulation wasn't very good. You know, he took Dimitri to be making arguments that, as far as I can tell, Dimitri wasn't actually making. So I did send Jim the full text of Dimitri's post, and he responded with the following. Jim wrote, "I still balk at some of his assertions," his being Dimitri Orlov's, "most notably the downplaying of fatalities. A woman at work has been sick since July. She got every symptom, cranked up to 11. She also tested negative 9 times. Therefore, his WHO IFR, which stands for World Health Organization Infection Fatality Rate, which, being a scientific outfit and stuff, I strongly suspect cannot attribute a fatality to someone who tests negative, no matter how many times the test is administered, is likely challengeable to the point of nullifying it. Health professionals, like my neighbor nurses, 2 anecdotal data points there, now treat symptoms and ascribe it to the plague official, no matter what the test says. That won't change the WHO, but it boosts on-the-ground info." In an earlier email, Jim had written the following. "People moving to the countryside would be necessary if we are to re-labor agriculture, to de-mechanize crop tending. These could be good jobs, though I doubt they will be. That trend is already starting. As I mentioned in our last conversation, the Joel Salatins of the world have been making some impact. If what they say were ever to affect crop subsidies, we could see a voluntary repopulating of the country in the next few years without engineering any plagues, since that absolutely isn't happening. My former objections to agriculture stand. If these evil geniuses wanted to ruralize the populace, they would have started with farm subsidies that drive workers to the cities and reward the biggest combines, trends which are damn near universal in many industrialized nations. I also reject his declaration of automation needing to be reduced. As we discussed in that etherealization/ephemeralization conversation, automation gets better and more energy efficient, so there's little reason to switch to PEEPs just yet. And his crime wave declarations don't pass the smell test. I live in what was described as a hotspot of such protests/crime sprees. So Jim lives in Seattle, and in Seattle we had the CHAZ, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, later renamed the CHOP, the Capitol Hill Occupied Precinct. I think that's what CHOP stood for. All of what we learned in this, we saw on the telly. It didn't happen here. Maybe a few miles away, but our friend living there thought it was a paradise that reminded them of the 60s, and that friend is over 80. Therefore, crime? Maybe culture changed, driving out the more staunch liberal haters. That's all I can accept of that statement. All in all, I eye-roll attributions of central control of massively spread conditions. This is not to say there aren't those who think themselves in charge, only that the conditions are so much better explained by the less nefarious. I think those countries destined for the meat hook, as he said, hung themselves upon it. They were not, so well hung by others. I could also change my mind in the next 5 minutes. Jim. Okay, so as to what I'll just call, you know, Dimitri's conspiracy theory surrounding COVID-19, you know, again, the fact that I call it a conspiracy theory doesn't mean that I'm asserting that it's false. But it is a narrative about conspiracies among powerful people that affect everybody. Now, of course, conspiracies do happen. You know, do you think all of the mainstream Democratic challengers to Joe Biden just happened to drop out the day before Super Tuesday and that Elizabeth Warren just happened to drop out the day after? Was that all just uncoordinated? Was that just emergent behavior, or was there a conspiracy there? I'm 99.999% certain that that all happened as the result of a carefully orchestrated conspiracy, largely within so-called Obama world. All right, so in all of that mess, there was the mention of automation. And in Dimitri's formulation, and granted, I don't read his stuff regularly, you know, so I'm drawing a lot of possibly erroneous conclusions about his message from this one post that somebody shared with me. But in it, he said that automation is a problem for the elites, you know, or the evil geniuses. And as far as I can tell, I mean, the only problem with automation is that it's not good enough yet to allow them to unleash, you know, the actual deadly virus that's going to kill off 97% of us. I don't know that such a virus exists, but I'm fairly confident that if one did exist, and if the elites could inoculate themselves against it ahead of time, that they would release it. Is that crazy talk from your perspective? If so, you know, that's okay. Just take my comments here as a data point, as a dot among many that you can use to draw whatever picture appeals to your psychology. But, of course, you know, I'm very much interested in artificial intelligence and automation, and I've recently listened to the book T-Minus AI, Humanity's Countdown to Artificial Intelligence and the New Pursuit of Global Power. This is by Michael Kanin. Kanin is K-A-N-A-A-N. And it's a pretty good book, but, you know, I've listened to a great many books on AI, and there are certain things that all of them feel the need to do, and it takes a while to do all that stuff, like, what is intelligence? Where did it come from? Let's dive into the, you know, human evolutionary psychology and the evolution of the various brain modules and the different cognitive capacities that each one facilitates. I'm super interested in all that stuff. I mean, that's basically my lifelong fascination. That's why I do a podcast called The C Realm, where C stands for consciousness. I mean, I'm really interested in all that stuff, but it seems like he spent so long laying out the groundwork that when he got to, you know, his talk of the present and the near future, I don't really remember what he had to say about it. So I'm going to have to go back and revisit that. But, I mean, the main point that I took from Michael Kanin's book, T-Minus AI, which, you know, I already believed, I was predisposed to accept this message, is that forget about artificial and general intelligence. Don't worry about it. It's a long ways off, and more importantly, narrow, domain-specific, very limited but incrementally increasing capabilities of AI, of narrow AI, is going to be massively disruptive. Don't worry about AGI. Don't worry about computers waking up. Don't worry about computers having common sense. I mean, long before any of that becomes a reality, if it ever does, narrow artificial intelligence is going to mess things up in a big way. Now, it's going to be great for some people. It already has been, you know, and if you're making $1 billion, if you're making a billion here and a billion there, and it just keeps snowballing, if your fortunes just keep snowballing because of this stuff, it is impossible for you to see this as a bad thing, you know? So even if you're not making billion over billion, but suppose, you know, you're making 2, 3, 4, 5 times what somebody working in a coffee shop does, and, you know, you certainly don't want to fall down to their level, and continuing, you know, to operate at the level at which you are operating is seeing your, you know, your ease, your comfort, and your social capital, you know, your prestige in the world. All of that is increasing, maybe not by billions of dollars, but by enough to make it, you know, really important to you that it be seen as a good thing. Well, again, you know, as Jim, your ad attacker, likes to quote Upton Sinclair, it's very hard to make a man understand something when his livelihood is dependent on his not understanding it. So anyway, T-Minus AI, Humanity's Countdown to Artificial Intelligence and the New Pursuit of Global Power by Michael Kanin. It's a good book that I need to re-listen to like the final third of it. But that's going to have to wait because I've just started, like just in the last couple days, started listening to the book The Technology Trap, Capital, Labor, and Power in the Age of Automation by Carl Benedict Frey. And this book is like 18 hours long. It is very methodical and it is very carefully researched and laid out. And, you know, as with all authors on information technology, it seems that maybe not all, in fact, probably not even most, but of people who write books on the topic, Carl Benedict Frey, who is a Swedish-born German-Swede, I guess, who teaches at Oxford, he goes deep into history, and he spends a lot of time talking about the first and second industrial revolutions, which mostly took place in Britain. And that's where I am in the book. But I also wanted a summation of the book, because as I say, it's a long, long book. And in books this long and this detailed, it is very easy to get lost in all the detail and not really understand the larger structure of the narrative that the author is laying down. So I went looking for a summation of it. And in that search, I found a really excellent summation slash review, which it was a public blog post. So it's out there in the world for anybody to read. So by my own lights, it's okay for me to read it to you. So here it is. This comes from the blog The Inquisitive Biologist, reviewing fascinating science books since 2017. So this is a book review of The Technology Trap, Capital, Labor, and Power in the Age of Automation. And The Inquisitive Biologist writes, "The robot apocalypse has become a well-worn trope that will elicit laughter more than concern. But there is a far more direct threat from artificial intelligence, or AI, economic disruption. Technology can and has taken jobs away from humans. I first started taking this idea more seriously after watching C.G.P. Gray's short documentary, Humans Need Not Apply. If you enjoyed that video, this book is the must-read follow-up. Economist and historian Carl Benedict Frey provides a soundly argued and clearly written book on the history of technological revolutions and what lessons those hold for future job security. What inspired Frey to write this book was a chance remark from a fellow economist after a conference where Frey had spoken on the potential impact of AI on jobs. Are these concerns not overblown? Is this not the Industrial Revolution all over again? People found new jobs then, they will now. They did, of course, but that glosses over a lot of subtleties." Okay, so I'm taking a break now from this blog post by the Inquisitive Biologist, because he doesn't really spell out what the author does in the book. The author says, you know, "I gave this talk, somebody came up to me and they said, isn't this just the, you know, the Industrial Revolution all over again? And I kind of shrugged it off. But then later, you know, as often happens, I came up with the right thing to say. It's like the right thing to say would have been, you know, if this is just the Industrial Revolution all over again, then this is enormous cause for concern, because the Industrial Revolution, the first one, caused enormous job displacement. And more importantly, the Industrial Revolution only happened when the powerful stopped stymieing technological innovation and started pushing it. And when they started pushing it, they called in the troops. You know, the workers who objected to these labor-eliminating devices, they often smashed machines. The British government, in turn, made it a capital crime to smash a machine. Smash up a loom, get hung. You know, for centuries, the British Crown had been telling people who wanted to automate the peasants out of a job, no, don't do that. But then when the British government, and it wasn't the monarchy by this time, when the British government decided that, no, it's probably good to go ahead and push this industrial technology as far and as fast as we can and fuck the workers. You know, that's not the goal, to disrupt the lives of working people, but it is certainly a price that we're willing to pay. They started hanging people. I mean, they just encoded it in law. Machines are more important than human lives. If a human is in conflict with a machine, we will kill the human. And so, yeah, there were riots. There were protests, and the British government's response was to send in the troops and bash some heads. So that's what the Inquisitive Biologist is referring to when he writes, "They did, of course, but that glosses over a lot of subtleties." So continuing with this review, there are two take-home messages in this book. First, whether technology is opposed depends on whether it will hit people where it hurts, their wallet. Second, as history shows, successful opposition requires the support of those in power. Without it, resistance is futile. This might seem self-evident, but what I found eye-opening is the distinction Frey makes between enabling and replacing technologies, as not all technology is the same. Enabling technology is usually a boon to workers, making them more productive or lightening physically demanding tasks. Replacing technology, however, usually meets with fierce opposition as it makes people's jobs redundant. As an example, where motorized vehicles were an enabling technology compared to horse-drawn wagons that improved the job of professional drivers, self-driving cars promised to be a replacing technology that could mean massive unemployment. These clearly formulated messages are embedded in a grand chronological narrative of technological development and its impact on human labor, providing a much-needed and mightily interesting perspective. Frey takes the reader from the agricultural revolution some 10,000 years ago through to the eve of the Industrial Revolution in Britain, which he examines in detail. This period of steam-driven mechanization and job replacement led into the second Industrial Revolution around 1880 with the discovery of electricity. The book's focus shifts to the experience of the United States, which emerged as a powerhouse of manufacturing. This time around, there was less resistance as living conditions improved and incomes were leveled across the board. This brings us to our current era, where automation has emerged as a new disruptive force, and inequality has grown once again. Finally, Frey carefully considers the future, with the looming specter of AI promising further upheaval. The above brief sketch of the book's outline fails to tell you just how fascinating the technology trap is. Frey shines a light on forgotten historical episodes and provides a book full of fascinating explanations and reasonable arguments. I will highlight three strands that struck me in particular. For one, a question I had never considered. Why did it take so long for the Industrial Revolution to happen? Consider that historically, there was no shortage of technological ingenuity and technical skill. From the engineering feats of the Greeks and the Romans, who were more interested in warfare than industry, through, yes, even the Dark Ages that saw windmills and ultimately the printing press, to the many scientific discoveries and inventions of the Renaissance. Leonardo da Vinci was but one of many inventors who were centuries ahead of their time. We had mechanical clocks, telescopes, and barometers long before the Industrial Revolution. So why the wait? Frey convincingly argues that the answer can be given in one word. Resistance. This is the technological trap of the book's title. As also shown in Sheila Ogilvie's recent book, The European Guilds, craft guilds shaped the economy for centuries. They looked out for their members and opposed progress, either legally or by force. Frey provides many examples of violent riots destroying early inventions, and guilds saw themselves supported by the ruling classes who feared social unrest, with royal edicts banning machines. It highlights one of the book's central messages, that successful opposition needs the support of those in power. This first changed in Britain. Yes, that mountain of coal on which it sat also helped, but was not the only factor. Increased competition between fledgling nation-states and the waning of the craft guilds brought about a shift, with the ruling elites siding with inventors, allowing mechanization to take off. This was an era of labor replacing technology, which initially saw inequality skyrocket as a shrewd few pocketed the profits. Understandably, there was resistance, but the machine-breaking Luddite revolts were violently suppressed. The narrative of them holding back progress took hold, which is why Luddite has negative connotations today. The second equally fascinating story is how we get out of this. The introduction of steam power in factories required higher skill levels to tend to those machines, allowing many jobless adult men to find work again. Meanwhile, child labor made way for childhood education. The arrival of electricity and the combustion engine continued the trend of mechanization, creating new labor-intensive jobs. This was an era of enabling technology, where wages grew and work floors became noticeably safer. Frey points out the breakthrough of what engineers call unit drive. Where early factories had a central power source, water, steam, later electricity, that transmitted motion to machines through a tangle of shafts and belts, at some point it became possible to outfit each machine with an individual motor. Frey's narrative here is largely U.S.-centric, focusing on, for example, the assembly lines and new factory layouts pioneered by the Ford Motor Company, and the numerous inventions that flooded domestic households. It was a time of unbounded optimism and progress that saw the rise of an affluent middle class. He reflects here on the tendency of economists of each era to try and formulate universal economic laws, such as Simon Kuznets did in the 1950s. Kuznets pushed the optimistic idea that technological progress brings initial economic inequality, After which, capitalism self-corrects for this with time by creating new job opportunities. That seemed to hold until about the 1980s, when automation changed the rules of the game again. The famous French economist Thomas Piketty considers this era of affluence a statistical anomaly, and some even suggest that violence and catastrophes are the only mechanisms that have historically leveled the economic playing field. The third and final theme I want to highlight is the age of automation, which Frey argues is not the Industrial Revolution all over again. This has not stopped some from drawing parallels between the two anyway, notably the economist Branko Milanovic, who thinks every technological revolution is accompanied by a Kuznets wave. Although there was a time when computers were human, they soon became, well, computers. This split the existing middle class, with a minority finding work in the cognitively more demanding new job sector of software engineering and programming, while the majority of blue-collar workers were displaced into less well-paid service jobs. I hasten to add that, for the sake of brevity, I am leaving out nuances here, as Frey does not claim that this is the only or decisive factor. It contributes to what is happening. So why do we not see machine riots now, with people smashing computers? One reason is political participation. The difference between then and now is that all adults have the right to vote. Make no mistake, there is discontent, and politicians play on these sentiments. Frey thinks this is an important contributor to the rise of today's populism and polarization. And we are not done yet, as AI is at our doorstep. Without giving hard predictions, Frey takes a very realistic look at current and future capabilities and limits of AI, and which jobs will likely disappear. He is not favoring a new technology trap by opposing progress, but as his book shows, progress always comes at a price in the short term, often spanning the decades of someone's working life. With the benefit of hindsight, governments can and should prepare for this, and Frey concludes with some policy recommendations. The threat that technology poses to job security is of significance to most of us. If you want to understand technology's impact, judge predictions about the future of work, or feel better informed when discussing these topics, you need to read this book. And the author of this review ends with the disclosure, the publisher provided a review copy of this book. The opinion expressed here is my own, however. All right, so I'm going to keep listening to the audiobook, even though I've gotten the grand tour of the whole thing here in this review. You know, I'm just into the second Industrial Revolution in the narrative of the book, but you know, I already knew that the Industrial Revolution was really an ugly time for working people. It was a great time for, you know, owners of factories, owners of capital, people who made money on trade, you know, but for people who had been artisans or had been, you know, subsistence farmers and now were pushed into a place where the common grazing lands and agricultural lands had been enclosed. You know, the people who had traditionally, over generations, worked those lands, pushed off of them, and sent to go make their way someplace else, doing God knows what. For those people, it was a really, really hard time. And yeah, in the long run, you know, now, 200 years later, of course, you know, of course we're happy that the Luddites failed. In the long run, for humanity in general, and for individual human beings living today, the technological progress that came of the Industrial Revolution in Britain 200 years ago is a great thing. But for the people who were working in those factories and the people who didn't get jobs in those factories, you know, who used to either work as artisans or agriculturalists, and suddenly those livelihoods just didn't work anymore in the context of rapidly changing technological, you know, of a rapidly changing technological field, those folks were just out of luck. And they never did enjoy the benefits of technological advancement. They were just crushed by it. So Carl Benedict Frey's position, something that he repeats a few times, is, yeah, things were okay in the long run, but the short run is the rest of your life. It's the rest of your working career. If you were displaced by technology in your late 30s, you're done. You are done. Your next job, if you get another one, is going to be a decided step down, both in prestige and pay and in, you know, the stability and dependability that a good job brings to life. But one of the details that was really shocking was that, you know, a lot of the people who were most immediately harmed by the new factories, which rendered the previous artisanal production methods obsolete, adult men. You could say adult men were hurt the most because they lost high-paying, high-prestige livelihoods, where the artisan's workshop was replaced by big factories filled with machines which were built to the scale of child bodies. Why? Because the industrial capitalists wanted to dismiss adult men and employ as many children as they could. Why? Because children, they couldn't negotiate. They couldn't object in any systematic way. Many of the children were never paid. You know, they were just given one meal a day and maybe a corner to sleep in. And when, you know, those meager rewards didn't motivate these child workers to work as hard as the managers wanted them to, well, the managers just resorted to corporal punishment. Children who didn't work hard enough or fast enough in their 18-hour-a-day daily shifts just got beaten. Well, the big losers again, you know, in this round of technological innovation and the restructuring of the whole, you know, how you make a living landscape, have largely been adult men. But at this point, there are more women in the workforce than there are men. The late 20th century, early 21st century corporate white-collar workplace prefers female workers. Women do better in college. You know, you could say that women are just more, they're just smarter, they have more book smarts, and they're more studious than men. But, you know, human psychology hasn't changed that much in recent millennia. But the landscape of education and occupation has changed dramatically in recent decades. So whereas it used to be, you know, colleges were mostly filled with men and women were the exception, now more women than men are admitted to college and more women than men are entering into the corporate office workspace. Of course, there are still industries where men vastly outnumber women. No amount of feminist studies is going to change the fact that most of the people, you know, working on crab boats in Alaska, you know, in the Bering Sea in January, are men. That is a physically and psychologically brutally punishing profession. You know, I worked in the Alaska fishing fleet in the summer. The summer is a very, very different animal from the winter. But I remember there was a guy on our boat. He was the old experienced hand talking about, you know, what it's like to work on a crabbing boat in the winter. And he said, you know, everybody just keeps working and the boat doesn't go back into port until everybody except the captain is injured, too injured to work. And those jobs are not going to get automated anytime soon. You know, a boat that is rocking and pitching and rolling in really rough seas in icy cold waters in Alaska. Oh, and the government really magnifies the harm by saying, you're not allowed to fish for this particular creature except during openings. And they will announce an opening, and an opening might be 42 hours or 72 hours. And, you know, boat captains are free to go out to designated areas and bring in as much as they can during that limited opening. But what does that mean? It means if it's a 72-hour opening, nobody on that boat sleeps for 72 hours. They just work until the opening is over. And they have to stop. And of course, you know, it's a dangerous environment to start with. And you give people a financial incentive to go 3 days without sleep, working round the clock. That's just, you know, it is a recipe for injury and death. And injury and death is a normal, regular, unremarkable occurrence in the fishing industry. But whereas in the past, radical disruptions to the job market have mostly hurt men, they've hurt men primarily. And, you know, of course, there have been trickle-down effects on women and children, but the initial harm was done to men. The next time around, that won't be the case, because men have already been kicked to the curb in terms of, you know, at least high-tech corporate office work. So the people who are going to be, you know, taking the real hit when AI shifts into high gear for the next round of, you know, human obsolescence, well, it's going to be women who are going to be taking the hit next time. Okay, so I'm going to wrap things up here. But because Dimitri's his post, which I haven't read to you because, you know, it was a behind the paywall thing. But because it carries the peak oil theme, you know, into this new era of, you know, geopolitical conspiracy theory. Again, just because it's a conspiracy theory doesn't mean it's wrong. Although in this case, I think it is so simplified as to be, you know, de facto wrong. But because Dmitry, you know, carries peak oil forward and basically says that the evil geniuses who run the world understand that peak oil is real and that it's about to land on us. And so they're scrambling to disperse the population and disempower the population and to strand the population in places where they can't really, you know, they can't gather together in enough numbers to threaten powerful people. Well, I just want to reemphasize, I've given peak oil way more serious consideration than most people have. Recorded, I don't know how many interviews on the topic, at least 100. Read many, many books on the topic. But I've also been reading books by people like, you know, I'll just start with the most ridiculous, Ray Kurzweil. If you look at Ray Kurzweil's predictions from the mid-90s to now, you know, look at what he predicted and look at what came to pass. And you compare that to the predictions of people like Richard Hindberg or Jim Kunstler. The most wild-eyed, you know, crazy pants, techno-utopian nut jobs, just in terms of their predictions, have done much better, have done much, much better than the peak oil doomers. In terms of predicting the events of what were then future years and which are now, to us, the recent past. Now, you could say that it was really easy for the techno-utopians to make very specific predictions about when technologies would mature because Moore's Law was such a constant for so long. Moore's Law has dramatically slowed down now, and it, you know, nobody counts on it being a, you know, a constant in the decades going forward. But even so, I mean, I remember I picked up Yuval Noah Harari's book, Sapiens, at somebody's apartment when I was living in Brooklyn. And I went directly to the index and I looked to see if he had anything to say on peak oil. And he did. And so, you know, I turned to the page that the index indicated, and I read his very short dismissal of peak oil concerns. And I don't remember what his exact argument was for concluding that the concerns about peak oil were unfounded. And I don't have the book. And I'm not going to go buy it just to read that one passage again. But I have since, you know, listened to audiobooks of several different books, including that one by Yuval Noah Harari, and his, you know, his larger story about the role of human intelligence and technology in the course of human affairs. It just seems a lot more cogent and a lot more in line with, you know, both long-term and recent history than does the peak oil fast collapse narrative. And I know the peak oil rejoinder is, you know, there's no more oil now than there was 5 years ago, 10 years ago. It's coming. But the only reason I was ever concerned about peak oil in the first place is because of the very, very short time horizon that people like Jim Kunstler and Dmitry Orlov were quoting back in 2007, 2008, which is when I really started to get into this thing. And here it is, 2020. We're at the end of 2020. And oil prices are through the floor, and we are awash in this stuff. We were awash in the stuff before the pandemic put the whole economy, the whole global economy, into what Dmitry describes as, you know, a medically induced coma. I definitely agree that the global political response to the pandemic, particularly in places like the United States, has been ridiculous, has created all manner of unnecessary hardship. And in spite of Jim knowing a few people who, you know, don't have comorbidities, you know, who don't seem to fit the model of the people who are really susceptible to coronavirus, how many people do you know who have died of it? How many healthy people do you know who have contracted this virus and died from it? If this was the 1918 Spanish flu and I ask you that same question, you would have no trouble just rattling off a list of people, a list of names of people that you know personally who were in the prime of life and who are now dead because of the Spanish flu. COVID-19 is not the Spanish flu. We've treated it as if it is, and most of the harm has come from the economic shutdown and the lockdowns, has come from the decision that people cannot go to work. They cannot do the things that they need to do in order to make a living, unless, of course, they're in that privileged class of people who can do their work from home. And I'm among that class of people. Now, Ed in Montreal, Ed the Willing, sent me a graph that showed me, you know, the severity and the damage done by the pandemic in every U.S. state, and Vermont is the state that is least affected out of the whole country. Vermont has the least percentage of cases, you know, per capita, the least, you know, fewest deaths, fewest hospitalizations, fewest infections. And it's, I think, largely because we're just not a very populous state. We don't have much population density. And, you know, the Vermont government has been pretty insistent. If you leave the state, I mean, if you don't live here, don't come here. You know, there is an Amtrak line called the Vermonter. You know, it's a north-south route. And the Vermonter line is still running, but it will not enter Vermont because the state government has said to Amtrak, stay out. Do not bring any people here. And so, you know, we are the least affected in terms of the metrics that people interested in the virus track. But I can tell you just from talking to people that a lot of people have been really, really hurt economically by the fact that restaurants are closed. That businesses where people used to go, you know, and spend time, you know, like the third place, bars, restaurants, the library, you know, places where people used to go and just be, that wasn't their home. Those places not only provided social opportunities for people, but they provided employment for people. Those people are now suffering. And, you know, I realize that unemployment has been beefed up, but a lot of people like me, I can't apply for unemployment. I mean, I don't need to. I haven't lost much income as a result of this pandemic because I work from home, because I work in the informal sector. But a lot of people who work in the informal sector have been harmed. They have lost the ability to trade their time and their effort for dollars, and they can't file for unemployment because they weren't employed to start with. They were working. They were working hard. They were diligent, hardworking people, but they weren't employed. So they cannot claim unemployment. Now, I realize in some states, and Vermont is one of them, you know, the rules for who can and cannot claim unemployment have been loosened a bit, but still, there are a lot of people who have been directly harmed who are not getting any help. So in spite of, you know, the firsthand accounts of like the ones I got from Jim, I still maintain that the primary harms of this pandemic have been self-inflicted. You know, if you consider the people making the decisions and the people suffering the consequences to be all one people, which, of course, they're not. We are not all in the same boat together. We do not have a shared fate. Okay, I said I was going to wrap it up, and then I started an unstructured rant. Now I am wrapping it up. I just want to say one thing. You know, I don't thank donors on this podcast because everybody, you know, ideally, everybody listening to it has paid a subscription fee. But some people pay more than I ask. And the most recent person to, you know, re-up for a year and pay more than I was asking for is Leet Minion, who, as you probably know, I mean, frequently, you know, if I'm reading some feedback from somebody who disagrees with what I said on the podcast, it's Leet Minion. And yet he not only continues to, you know, pay what I'm asking, he pays above and beyond what I'm asking for access to this material. So thank you to Leet Minion, and thank you to everybody who subscribes at whatever level. I do very much appreciate it. Alrighty. Well, December is almost half over, and this is the first Vault podcast you've gotten from me this month. There will be more. Dermot O'Connor, the angry animator, was the guest on my live stream just a couple days ago. And I think almost everything that we said in that, you know, isn't specifically related to what's being drawn on screen will be of interest to you. So it's, you know, it's a long recording. It's going to take me a while to edit out the stuff that is not relevant, you know, to people just listening to a podcast. But it is coming your way in the next few days. Thank you very much for your patience. All right. Now I stop talking and start editing. Wish me luck. Talk to you soon.